The following program does not necessarily reflect the views of the staff or management of WFMD.
Yeah, but you know, I've been at these stations for a long time, and who cares what they think, you know? That's my motto.
That statement definitely doesn't represent their opinions.
What are they going to do? Take the show off the air? Oh, they might. Actually, I care a lot what they think. This is the Faith Debate. I'm Troy Skinner. Those laughing nervously behind me are David Forsey, Daniel Razvi, and Imran Razvi. We are all pastors of churches in the area that happen to be house churches. There's three different churches that are represented here. One of them is on the north end of town up by Thurmont. One's in the south end of town. What's that, like the Knoxville area? Is that what, Brunswick? What is that considered?
Yeah, probably more people know Brunswick, but yeah.
Okay, and then there's Household of Faith in Christ, which is mine, which is pretty much dead center in the county. And you can find us online at householdoffaithinchrist.com and learn more about us and what we're all about. And you can reach out. And it was mentioned to me that I should suggest to you that we would pray for you. And I can't promise that, but I know Imran will. So if you need a prayer, you reach out, and we will pray for you, including Imran. So my email, my cell number, it's all on our website, householdoffaithinchrist.com. We've been talking in recent weeks about family matters, marriage, children. Last week was talking about learning disabilities and how to raise children with that. And this week we're going to transition to sibling relationships. By the way, something I meant to mention last week, it's going to be a little out of context in this case, but there's research out there that would seem to indicate, if you don't know the name, I think his name is Samuel Blumenfeld. Do you know that name by any chance?
I think so.
He's the guy that kind of turned me on to there's this research that indicates a lot of people that have what gets diagnosed as dyslexia was caused by trying to learn how to read whole word as opposed to through phonics. So if you've got a child that's struggling with their reading and struggling, therefore, just academically in general, maybe you want to go back to square one and work on training them up in phonics and see if that doesn't help it. And I would say nip it in the bud. Don't let your child learn how to read whole word. Help your child to learn how to read phonics. So, and if you do that, you'll have well-adjusted children who will get along well as siblings. I tried to squeeze it all back together. We're talking about a bunch, the last 4, 5, 6 weeks now, we've talked about a series of materials, books, and things available through Conquered by Love Ministries. They have a website, conqueredbylove.org, and the Razvis founded that and run that. And they've got a number of books, several dozen books that are out there. And four of them are called Conquering Sibling Rivalry, How to Have Children Not Fight, That's Not Fair, Conquering Jealousy, Chores, How and Why to Teach Siblings to Work Well Together on Chores, and Sharing and Contentment. So those all seem to fit in the sibling area. I know that last week we got a little bit one-sided as far as the number of voices that got a chance to participate. So I'm going to start this week with David and make sure you have a chance to get a few words in, a few licks in before, you know, the other three of us just run off with the show.
All right.
You've got, what is it, 5 kids? Right?
I have 5 kids. And I guess just for context's sake, we have a set of twins and then three, they were first, and then 3 kids after that. And so we had 5 kids within 5 years. So they're all really near in age.
Any rivalry?
No, none at all.
So you have nothing to add to this conversation. Or you can tell us how that happened. How do you have no rivalries?
I grew up in a family, though, where we were pretty spread out. My sister and I are very close in age, but then my other 2 brothers, 5 years down to the next one, then 5 more years down to the next one. And so the family dynamics, I think, are pretty different in situations where the kids are spread out.
Was it easier when they're spread out or harder when they're spread out?
Well, I wasn't my parent, but I think they were probably more difficult just from thinking about my experience. And I'm very good friends with all of my siblings now, but we didn't really become closer. I mean, I'd say even really like get to know each other very well until we were grown-ups and sort of all on the same stage of life in that sense, married and having our own kids.
Right.
But all of my children know each other really well. They're very good friends with one another, partially because of that closeness in age. And but I mean, even there, like our our twins, the oldest, are girls, and our youngest is a girl. And so there's just those few years distance that, you know, sort of make it hard for them to connect sometimes. But I guess first I'd say, like, siblings are a great thing. I think it's probably...
He says that because he's concerned they're going to listen to this show.
I think it's a huge benefit to kids to have siblings. Just like, you know, I think with you know, getting married is a huge benefit because it's a lot of work and it makes you grow up and mature in a lot of ways and learn things about yourself and relating to other people. And same thing about when you have kids, and then if those kids are able to have siblings, more relationships, you know, they're around them, that is good for them.
And as I've been talking to some people recently, and, you know, people who think that the world has lost its mind, and they're like, you know, what can I do? And if they're young enough, I say, have babies. Because you know, assuming Christ doesn't return in the interim, the long haul strategy here is to outnumber them. So if you're a good, solid, you know, right thinking, particularly if you're a Christian, have babies and lots of them. And I think we would all be shocked at what the world would look like in 40 years if all the Christian families had 10 kids and all the secularist, you know, knuckleheads out there didn't have any kids.
Or killed their kids.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Which is what they want to do with
that. That would be transformative inside of a generation. But the problem is so many believing families don't have a lot of kids either, because I get it. Back in the day when it was an agrarian economy, it was a little easier perhaps to understand why you would want to have 15 or 20 kids. Now it's hard financially to have a lot of kids. I get it. But you guys have a lot of kids. You figured it out.
We're doing our part. We got 13 kids. And yes, it is expensive. But the thing is, who's providing for the kids? You or God? As soon as you give it over to God, God will provide. Then the rest doesn't matter.
So you have 13.
And
that means there's lots of divvying up for the chores, right? So is that easy when there's 13 kids to divvy up? Because they don't have,
yes.
Because I was an only child for 15 years until my sister finally came along. And so for 15 years, I was the only one doing the chores. I feel like that was maybe harder for my parents to motivate me to do my chores than it would have been if there were 12 others to share those duties.
It's helpful if there's several kids. Sorry, you're good.
No good.
It's helpful if there's several kids, particularly if you can pair them up. And so what we did, my mom did, is she made charts, and, you know, they would rotate. So you'd have a rotation, and you'd pair up with one sibling for the next day or so, and you do chores that day with that person, and then you switch up with another person the next day. And you do chores with a different person every day, and every time you do the chores with a different person. So you learn to do all the different chores. It's not just, oh, my job is to do the dishes and somebody else does the laundry. No, I learned the dishes and the laundry and all the other things. But we did it with a different person each time, so that avoids children just becoming attached only to one sibling, and they can only get along with that person and not anybody else if they're spending all their time with that one person, because children that work well together will play well together. So if they can learn how to work together, and the rules were you can't just do it by yourself and before the other person gets there, you've got to actually do it together. And you both have to pitch in on this chore, and then you rotate with another person. So now you learn how to work with every single one of your other children, other siblings, and you get along with them. So chores are a really, really great thing for teaching sibling relationships.
Do you do something similar at your house where the kids take turns who they're doing chores with? That's a cool. I never heard of that idea.
We do have a chore rotation. We don't have a rotation of teams, so everyone is learning to do, you know, all of the various types of things.
Does that ever lead to fights where the kids are like, hey, I'm doing more of the work on this chore, or so-and-so did a really bad job cleaning the toilets last week, and so now it's my turn to clean the toilets?
My kids are definitely more critical of others. They have various standards sometimes. And, so that's an issue. That's something that they have to work through.
It's not fair. Well, life is not fair, and we don't treat our children the same. Not one child gets treated the same as another child. Just like we tell our kids, just like flowers. Some flowers need shade, some flowers need sun, some flowers need a little bit of both. We can't treat them all the same, otherwise they will die. So we treat our children differently.
And I see a lot of kids say, oh, that's not fair. You did this for that person. And And a lot of parents, they don't know how to respond to that. They're like, okay, yeah, let me make it fair by doing this. No, don't make it fair. You shouldn't make it fair.
Let me write you a check. Give you some reparations.
Exactly. God doesn't treat us all fairly. You know, not all equally. So there's a difference between being equal and being equitable. And I think we have that problem in society, too. A lot of people think, oh, they need to have equal of everything, not be equitably treated. And there are two different things.
Yeah, there's a story from back in the 90s, and I've said it a number of times over the years, possibly on this show once upon a time, I don't know. But there was a special teams football player for the Dallas Cowboys in an important game, like in November or something, in the playoff push, and he made a dunderheaded decision or whatever and ended up turned into a turnover, a fumble or something. The other team recovered, ended up scoring, and the Cowboys, I guess, lost the game. That part, whether they won or lost, I don't know, but it was a major blunder. I think they lost the game. And so Johnson, what was Johnson's first name? Jimmy Johnson. Jimmy Johnson was the coach at the time, and Jimmy Johnson cut the player in the middle of the season, which doesn't typically happen, unless they do something like in their personal life, drugs or spousal abuse, something like that. But for a mistake in the game, you don't typically get cut in the middle of the season. He cut him, and he got kind of called on it by the media, or they tried to call him on it in the media, saying, Coach Johnson, I mean, you cut, you know, Mr. Dunderhead over there because he's a special teamer. I mean, if Emmitt Smith fumbled and you guys lost, you wouldn't have cut Emmitt Smith. I mean, you're playing favorites. You're treating your players differently based on their station within the team kind of thing. And his answer to that was, I thought, brilliant. He said, no, let me correct you. I treat all my players exactly the same, individually. I was like, that's the flowers idea, yeah. Right? That's, yeah, right. I treat them exactly the same as individuals who have different kinds of needs and different sorts roles. Of different roles and that sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah. So when they're saying it's not fair, is it as simple as just saying, well, life's not fair? Or do you have to kind of sit down and have one of those daddy talks with the little one and say, well, let me explain to you how the world works? Or like,
it's age dependent, right? So it depends on where they are and the things that they'll comprehend. But I think it begins with, you know, even before you're able to even have conversations. Part of it too is you know, making it clear that the majority of the decisions are, you know, are mommy and daddy's, and that's fine, and that's right. And so, you know, I give you this cup and I give you this cup, and that's fair because that's what mommy and daddy decided to do. That is a good thing.
And really, I didn't want to treat you fair because I want to love you. And loving you might be something different than loving one of your siblings. And we do examples. I mean, for example, if it was fair, here, why don't you, there's 15 people in this family. So here's the pot that we had to cook dinner in. Just clean 1/15th part of this pot. Because that's fair, right? Don't clean the others because you don't want to do it for somebody else. Or you just clean your mess. How much dust did you bring in? Just clean 1/15th of the dust that was in there.
And the baby gets milk for dinner. So now we're only going to drink milk. Everybody. Nobody gets any meat. Nobody gets any vegetables. No dessert. Just milk today.
That's fair.
That's fair, right? And the kids start laughing. Oh, no, that would be crazy. You're right. It would be. That's why we treat everybody differently.
And the biblical thing there, God gives everybody unique talents and abilities and situations in life, right? One person is born, and they're going to grow to be, you know, 6 feet 10 inches tall and make billions of dollars playing basketball. And somebody else will be born, and they're only going to be 5 foot 2, and basketball is not going to be in the cards for them. Well, that's not fair. Well... And so God isn't fair in that regard, right?
But he also doesn't make mistakes.
Right. That's true. Yeah, and we've got examples of sibling rivalries going awry in Scripture.
Yeah, from the beginning.
Yeah, from the very beginning. So sibling rivalry books, the ones we have, are really our best-selling books for our ministry. Wherever we go, they're the most in demand. That are, when we do a speech, that's the most in-demand speech or a conference talk that we do is sibling rivalry. Because it seems like if you have more than one child, there's going to be rivalry. Why? Because we're always striving Okay, God built us to strive. We're going to strive and try to achieve and try to be better, and that's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. The difference is we need to change who we're going against instead of our sibling. Change it against sin. We're going to strive against sin, but strive together. Be on the same team. So we have to readjust as we're going to strive for something or strive against something, strive against sin, strive together with your sibling and conquer together. So because we're designed to strive, to achieve, to grow, and to conquer things, let's do it together. We just have to realign what they're fighting and what's going on. On that note also, sharing and contentment. I've had so many people say, now, Jimmy, you must share with your sister. Here, take the ball out of Jimmy's hand and give it to Susie. That is absolutely the worst thing you can do to Jimmy. You're undermining his faith in you that you're going to protect him. You're undermining his feeling of being safe and being taken care of and being loved because you're taking something out. His security. You're damaging his security. The less secure he feels, the more he will act out. So what we do with sharing is totally different. And we've told many, many parents, taught many parents, and it's worked, and they come back with high praises on this, is look, they don't have to share. But when you're done playing with that ball, then Susie would like it. Okay? And Susie, you just got to wait. And you know what? If you never get a chance to play with that ball, so let's say it's at a swing set. We're at a park, and Jimmy's on the swing set, and he's swinging. When he's done, you don't have to share. When he's done, Susie can get a turn. What if he never gets done and we leave? Will that keep Susie out of heaven? Absolutely not. So it's okay that Susie did not get a chance to be on the swings and Jimmy hogged it the entire time. But Jimmy became more secure and he's more likely to share on his own accord because now he's secure and wants to share, wants to give, because we want our children's hearts to be in such a way that they want to give and love as opposed to trying to hold on. The more you take away, the harder they're going to hold on to their whatever they have because they feel insecure.
It seems almost counterintuitive because it goes against almost any and every childhood experience I had, and yet it makes total sense because you think about it, forced sharing involves theft. If I'm going to force David to share his phone with you and he doesn't want to, I have to steal his phone from him to give it to you.
It's called taxation. It's called taxation.
So it makes sense, actually, but I don't know.
But it also
I don't
teaches,
know anybody that does that other than you guys.
It also teaches Susie something different, too, right? Because if you force Jimmy to give it to Susie, whenever Susie says, oh, I want that toy, well, now you're teaching her to be jealous, to be discontent. That's why the book is called Sharing and Contentment. Because you need to teach sharing, but you need to teach contentment also. And if you teach sharing by making people discontent,
now, what when they're really, really little and their language skills aren't? Because I've seen this with toddlers, let's say, right? And somebody's playing with the fun musical toy that lights up and has all bells and whistles, and the other kids, ooh, and they want to go take it, and they start yanking it from each other.
Nope. Daniel's daughter is 15 months old, and already she's content. She will wait, and if she doesn't get something, she will wait patiently because we've taught her that way. And
what's the method there? How do you communicate that with a pre-verbal child?
Oh, let me push back a little bit on that question. I know what you're meaning, with a very young child, but I wouldn't say pre-verbal. An infant that's 5 days old knows what words are, and they understand you. They understand very, very well, far more ahead than you might think that they understand words. The difference is most parents don't assume that their children understand what they're saying, and so they either talk baby talk to them or they don't use full, complete sentences. I use complete sentences with my baby. When when she was hungry, I said, oh, are you hungry? And at 1 month old, she would say, hungry, hungry. She was actually mouthing all the syllables for hungry. And it meant what it meant. And she would use, she didn't always use complete sentences, obviously. She used sign language. She might say a word here or there. But we always use complete sentences and talk to her like she's an actual person rather than a dog or, somebody that's not, that doesn't have intelligence. But with all of that, yes, when somebody's playing with something and I can see my baby wants that, I'll say, oh, great, yeah, they're having fun, let's watch them. When they're done, maybe we can have a turn. And if it looks like it's going to be a while, I'll say, oh, let's go try this thing. And we'll just go and do that. And I'm not going to wait around for her to say, okay, fine, I'm happy about it now. We're just going to go ahead and do it, and we'll find something to be happy about. If you act excited and all about some other thing that we're going to do, the baby would quickly shift their priority to whatever you're excited about. Because you can instill that in the baby.
I absolutely agree. And one of the things that Daniel said, you know, being able to speak that early is rare because the vocal cords are not developed well enough, and many babies cannot do that. Now, Daniel's baby was born with a tooth, so I think she's a little overdeveloped already. But that aside, we taught our babies sign language. When we would say something, we would sign it, and they would understand. Children sign nurse, sign more, sign thank you, sign please, before they could speak. And they would communicate very well. So pre-verbal, yes, they can still understand a lot. And as Daniel was saying, if you're, as a parent or as a caregiver, are excited about something, you can easily shift their attention to something else. And we don't use no. No, you can't play with that. You know that. Hey, Bobby's playing with that right now. We'll wait until Bobby's done. If he's not going to get done, that's okay. We'll find something else to play. And boy, this is going to be really exciting. Let's go try this. So always it's going to be an alternative instead of a no. So, hey, instead of saying no, don't do that, say let's do this instead. Because children, and as you said, pre-verbal, you know, we see no, we understand what no means, but children really see in pictures. But they don't see a picture of no. What do you picture when you say no? You see a circle with a line through it, right? But children don't have that picture.
Yeah, and we learned that through the special needs training with our son. No is a trigger word for him, and not for the reasons you would think, like he doesn't want to be denied something he wants to do. No conceptually can be a confusing word. Because there's no action that is exactly connected to it. So if they're pressing the button on the remote and you want them to stop, then you need to say stop. Because there's an action like, oh, cease doing. But no is like the answer to a question, a yes, no question. You didn't answer. I didn't ask a question. Why are you telling me no? Like they're not thinking that sort of
stuff. Yeah, it's helpful to give the put on action, right? So if... I mean, even when our babies were crawling, you know, if they're crawling towards something that they shouldn't be getting into, you know, you can say, you know, do this instead. I, you know, even if it's something as simple as, you know, is there something, say, walk away, you know, is a phrase that we've used with kids at different stages. You know, and that basically communicates, you know, you know, choose something else, you know, choose a different direction. And back on the sharing thing, we did things very similar to the way you all talked about, Daniel and Raz.
It's just you that are left out, Troy. I mean, you're
maybe because I was an only child for 15 years.
The only thing
had two
I would
kids, only one of them was typical development, so I didn't have the experience.
The only thing I would add, and maybe you all did this too, but just sort of we also like encouraged our children to notice the desires of one another. So you know if someone is. I guess one way that we would encourage sharing is we would say, you know, like you can see that someone else would like a turn, you know, maybe do this for a few more minutes, you know, enjoy it for a few more minutes and then,
ready.
Yeah. But, and then, you know, and then offer it to them.
But when you're ready and I wouldn't tell the child they had to do that unless it was something we had made a plan ahead of time. Say, we're going to go over here. Everybody's going to get a turn. It's going to be 5 minutes each. And they already know before they start playing with it that that's what they're going to do. But if somebody, usually the sharing conversation comes up when somebody, I want that. It looks fun. I want that. No, I'm playing with it. Hey, mommy, he won't give me a turn. Yeah, that's more of a discontentment on the child that's complaining rather than. But what we will say is, if somebody really wants to be a jerk about it and say, look, I'm playing with this forever. Okay. Well, as soon as you set it down to do anything else, you're done with it. You can't say, "Oh, I'm holding this. I'm eating dinner now, but I'm going to play with it afterward." Or, "No, I'm going to set the Lego down. I'm going to play with my, my robot set for a little bit, but I still have the Legos in my left hand." No, you're playing with something else now.
Yeah,
so the other person needs a turn.
And that's going to put a wrap on this week's show. So we're running against the clock. This is the Faith Debate on 930 WFMD. Find all of us. Connect with us online at householdoffaithinchrist.com. Of course, the radio station's website as well, WFMD.com. Till next week, 167 and a half hours from now.